Hi everyone, and I think you're gonna absolutely love today's episode because my guest didn't have the traditional route into the top of elite sport. He went to college first, then he went and studied at NASA, and then to go and be a part of a team that was just pipped the Premier League title as well as playing in one of the most iconic FA Cup finals of all time. I think you're gonna absolutely love this. So let's get into it. Hi everyone, and welcome back or welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh, and if you're joining us for the first time, I'm a performance psychologist and keynote speaker, and I'm on a mission to understand the world of elite performance. Now, I've been really fortunate in the first few episodes to get real insight from the worlds of international rugby, the Olympics, the NFL, and sports psychology, but today is my own sport, football. Now, today's guest has been voted the best ever goalkeeper at one of his former clubs. He's played over 200 games in the Premier League and represented his country at the World Cup. These days, he works as a TV analyst in America for ESPN covering English football. So please welcome Shaka Hislop. Shaka, how are you doing, my friend? And where in the world are you?
I'm just outside Boston now, Paul. That's where I call home. Good to see you again. It's been far too long.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to give you my first question that I've asked everybody so far at the very start of the show. And that is, Shaka, what is the definition of success?
Oh, that's a tough one, Paul. Let me see. On the one hand, shameless plug here. I did a TEDx talk for Trinidad and Tobago recently, and I spoke about success. And I said success is something that you get to define and then redefine and redefine again. And that certainly has been my own journey, my own experiences with success. It meant something very different to a 16-year-old, to me being 27 or 28 years old and playing in the Premier League to what it means to me now. I think success is a comfort and a confidence that maybe you've achieved more than the sum of your own parts. And that can mean anything to anyone. And that's certainly how I feel about success now. And as I look back on my career and my journey through it, how success has was defined and evolved through the years.
Brilliant. So such a comprehensive answer already. And I, to be honest, I expected nothing less from you because, you know, it's really interesting because obviously most people would know you from your days of playing football and, of course, now working on ESPN, analysing it and understanding it and sharing that with people across the world. But actually, you had a completely different way into professional football, didn't you? Because you actually went to university, which is interesting because I talked to Jay Fielder, who is a quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, and he talked about how when he went to college, he had no interest or no desire to become a professional athlete. Was that similar to yourself?
No. Listen, and you're right. My journey is very different. Growing up in Trinidad and Tobago, playing football in Trinidad and Tobago, certainly at the time, there was no professional league. And the only real option to players coming through secondary school at the time was everybody went to the US to pursue a university degree. You get some kind of a profession, you know, football pays your way through school, and you find a job in that profession once you graduated. And that was the path I, well, intended to follow. So leaving school in Trinidad and Tobago, I was recruited by Howard University, which is an HBCU based in Washington, D.C., a school with a rich Caribbean heritage to it, particularly in their football program. I was offered a half scholarship that paid for my tuition. And my intention was to go on and just get a mechanical engineering. I'd always dreamed of designing cars. So that was what I thought the future held for me. And it was only a year before graduating, I actually did a summer internship at NASA headquarters, which allows me for my most horrendous joke and most overtold joke. A summer I spent at NASA where everything went over my head. There you go. I got the joke all out the way. You're all safe now. But I remember then speaking to my mentor at NASA, a guy by the name of Greg Switek, about what direction I wanted to go, what direction I wanted my career to go in. And because I was doing well at school, I had offers to maybe go on and do a master's program on scholarship after. And speaking to Greg about it, and he said, listen, give football a shot. Could be one shot. You can always come back to engineering, but you don't want to be an engineer wondering what if. If you give it that one shot and it fails, at least you gave it that shot. And that is exactly what I did. That was my intention. Through the stars aligning, which we can get into later on if you like, I was offered a trial at Reading. And I remember walking around the town center, looking at job centers, at advertisements for jobs, and actually saw an engineering job advertised in exactly the specialization that I did at Howard, mechanical engineering, specializing in robotics. And the starting salary was £20,000. And I made my mind up there that if somehow somebody offered me a contract, £20,000 would be my starting salary, or that would be what I would be asking for, because I knew that's what I could get as an engineer. Long story short, Reading eventually offered me that trial, eventually offered me a contract for £20,000. So it kind of worked out in that regard, and the rest from there, as they say, is history. So. Yes, my route was different, but at the time, it pretty much was the only one that I had available to me.
Yeah, and listen, there's so many things I wanted to pick up. First of all, everything going over your head, 4 feet nothing. that happens a lot.
Sorry about that.
When you're over 6 feet. Secondly, amazing that you're talking about, being at NASA, and that must just have been an incredible experience. And actually, my last guest, Jamil Qureshi, who's a performance psychologist, was allowed to go and study the astronauts at NASA. So maybe we just need to touch on that a second. And just what was that like in terms of being around possibly the brightest people in the world, and you had the opportunity to study with them?
Incredible. Let me just say, being around people who have achieved as much as people in NASA headquarters have, who have the kind of reputations and CVs that they did and still do, is empowering in a number of ways. One, you get to recognize that they're human. I think when you're looking in at the outside, and if we talk about NASA's lead engineer, there is this belief that they're almost Martian, that while it's true that they've achieved these incredible things, sharing a space with them, you recognize how much like you they are, but at the same time how focused they have to be on what they do, and how they find balance between that focus, that drive, and just being a regular Joe out on the street. As much as Greg Switek was in charge of the Space Station Freedom project back in the 90s, as an engineer in his mid-30s, overseeing everything about that project, you wouldn't know that if you see him walking down the street. You wouldn't know that if you decided to have a chat with him in line at the local coffee shop. And I think that's something that Sydney, as a young man, allows you to recognize maybe some of your own potentials, despite what you feel are some of your own feelings, your own humanness.
Yeah, and because it's again, as I'm starting to do these conversations with very successful people like yourself, Shaq, it's funny because I had Chris Akabusi, you know, who's a world champion, still a world record holder. You know, he's talking about he wanted to be around the best in the world. And for him, the best in the world when he was competing was Ed Moses. So he went off to LA and he was with him and he just said, you know, proximity is power. And you're saying the exact same thing. But then I also feel like jumping ahead to when you were signed at Newcastle and you're around the likes of Kevin Keegan and Les Ferdinand and all these superstars, just how normal these guys are. And it's the exact same at NASA.
Yeah, exactly the same. And that certainly is what I found. You mentioned my time at Newcastle, and that for me was transformative in so many ways. I'm sharing a dressing room with John Barnes, Peter Beardsley, Ian Rush was at Newcastle with me for a time, Kevin Keegan, Kenny Dalglish, Alan Shearer, Les Ferdinand. The names just roll off the tongue. Players that I looked up to, both as a young man coming up in the game and as someone involved in the game. Yet here I am sharing a dressing room with them. Here I am sparring, for want of a better term, with them on the training ground, and then going back into the dressing room after and talking about, well, let's go get lunch, or shall we meet up for dinner later, or whatever it may be. There is such value to that, and I felt as a result maybe my experience within the Newcastle dressing room served West Ham or Sydney, my contributions to West Ham, better than it did to Newcastle, you know, because I was just immersed in this dressing room, immersed in this excellence, and recognizing that, you know, I can be here, I can share in and learn from this. And I felt that experience, as much as anything, made me a better goalkeeper.
And that's what I want to come back to a little bit later on, because I want to keep the kind of the Newcastle stuff for more the second half of the show, Shaka, because I really, I still need to understand how you go from, you know, pretty much young kid studying, and obviously you were studying, you know, at a really high level. But then you suddenly come into this whole new world, whole new industry of professional football in a different country. I know you were born in London, but you actually, you know, you're then now living in England with this new contract, minimal contract at Reading. What were the adjustments or what were some of the things that really helped you go from a young kid trying to make your way to suddenly, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, being voted their best ever goalkeeper?
I think some of those adjustments were made very early on, and maybe unknowingly. Now, I've never considered myself that bright or that good a student. And I have quite a few teachers in Sydney during my high school time where that would attest to exactly as much. I've never considered myself that great an athlete either. I felt what I could do is certainly in terms of the classroom, I could approach that almost like a competition and I could out-compete other students. And then on the football field, I felt that I could outthink other athletes. And that kind of is how I approached a lot of what I did, both academically and athletically. And I saw success from it. You know, I proudly boast to graduating third in my engineering class at Howard University, despite playing varsity sports throughout. And despite I don't think I was at all the greatest or the best goalkeeper that Trinidad and Tobago produced, not in my time and not in any time since. But I felt that I could outthink so many others, and that's what I tried to do. That was my adjustment. It was kind of the same approach. It was just a different arena, so to speak.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Shaki, you talk about, you know, establishing yourself in that Reading team, and you did so well, you know, getting promotions and understanding what it's like to be a top performer. Suddenly you find yourself as Newcastle. You touched on that earlier, but what do you think was the biggest step up, the biggest change, or maybe even psychological shift you needed to make when you walked into that dressing room with the likes of the Beardsleys, Ferdinand, Ginola's, etc.?
I think, in all honesty, the biggest psychological shift for me came in my introduction to professional football. And all of a sudden, you had to be at your absolute best every single day, day in, day out. It's not an approach, certainly footballing-wise, that I was used to, and one that it took some adjusting to, psychologically and physically. I suffered injuries very early on when I first joined Reading, as I did with Newcastle, and they step up at class as well. But that, for me, that mental adjustment, that mental tuning was the biggest adjustment for me during the course of my career. And it's one, I think, that served me well throughout, not just during my own playing career, but in my time post-football as well, that you have to be at your best. You have to give 100% every single training session. There's no time. There is no training session that you go at 99. You don't allow yourself the luxury of complacency. I think that's how you get the best out of yourself. Coming into Newcastle, similarly. So now I've got that mindset that I have to be at my best every single day. I have to have that focus. All of a sudden, there's a step up in class. There's a step up in expectation. There's a step up in pressure. And you have to do all these things that you just figured out how to do at Reading with so much more now at stake, not just in terms of your performance on the field on a Saturday, but every single day and how people react to you if you aren't. If you don't give 100%, if we're all human, sometimes our 100% on this day looks a lot like 50% on another. But, you know, that's just some of the feelings of being a human being. And how you cope with that, how you cope with that criticism, which may be justified, but at the same time, may be unfair, just given. Again, your own humanness, and how you cope with that criticism, how you cope with expectation on yourself, and establish a presence within the dressing room. Because I'm coming into, as much as Newcastle paid for me in terms of a transfer fee, I'm coming from a lower league club up into a club that is expecting to challenge for the Premier League. That's a big step up for a young man to make who's 3 years into a professional career and not gone through, you know, academy systems and kind of understand the mentality that comes with being a part of a professional football club. That was for me the biggest adjustment that I had to make in moving from Reading to Newcastle.
And Shaka, this is when you talk about, you know, being around these players. So even if we just take someone like an Alan Shearer, you know, everybody knows greatest Premier League goal scorer in history, and you're playing against him every single day in training. Now, I can only imagine the standards that he sets with everybody in terms of his own performance. And then, of course, what he demands of you. So I just want to unpick a little bit what you said, because you talk about, you know, how do you cope? And it's interesting, some of the messages and feedback I've got from people who are listening to this, they say, you know, it's great that, you know, people get to a certain level, but a lot of people are interested is how do you cope? What is it when Alan Shearer is giving you a really hard time day in, day out, because you're not performing at the level he expects?
That's tough. That, I listen, I've been there. you know, and that is really tough on you in a number of ways. When there are players that you look up to, players who have achieved and continue to achieve and set a certain standard around who they are and who they want in their orbit. And if you don't make the grade, their reaction to it and how you have to respond. That for me is very tough to kind of endure. But at the same time, you have to recognize that moment, what that stands for, and you also have to appreciate the tone and the what that moment is actually asking for. And I say that because, and as footballers, and you know this, Paul, I'm sure you'd experience it. Whether it's during a game or in a training session and something doesn't go well, somebody makes a mistake, somebody's just having one of those days, could be me or anyone else, and you have this exchange, a very heated exchange, that to somebody looking in from the outside feels nasty. Feels vicious, feels like an attack. And then you have, you know, you go back into the dressing room, you have a shower, and you and that exact same person talks about, well, shall we go such and such and have lunch? And it's as though it never happened. And I think that for me was also kind of was revealing as to how, you know, you separate the ask of being a professional footballer to the wider ask of being a friend and a teammate. Because sometimes they seem out of sync, but only when you've been in it long enough, you realize how closely they're related. That we have to be honest with each other when we're talking about performance. We have, at times it may feel harsh, but we all have those days. We all recognize those days, even when, you know, we're in the midst of having that exchange. And then we go off and we have to be a friend. We have to be a support. And it may come moments after being that person's harshest critic. That for me is also something I think, and maybe I'm being a little bit arrogant here, sport teaches you in a way that I'm not sure I would have learned being a NASA, even if I did go on. I'm not sure I ever would have been being a NASA engineer or an engineer for anybody else.
And when that really, what you're talking about there is almost trying to take the emotion out of it and separate between demands and expectations of just simply wanting to be the best. And not only is one person doing that, but actually dragging other people with them if at any stage their standard slip. So you talked about their performance, and it sounds like, you know, you were playing in the team, you know, he's just missed out on a Premier League title. You're playing with some of the best players in the world. Can you maybe give us a little bit of an insight into the leadership qualities that you were either displaying yourself or observing from the players or coaches around you?
Yeah, I think to play in teams like that, it takes a high level and albeit unrecognized at the time, of emotional IQ, just kind of understanding the people around you and getting the best out of the people around you. I feel that sport affords us some of the greatest lessons in life, especially team sport, in that, you know, there are days that you aren't going to be at your best, but you somehow have a duty to the team. You have a responsibility to the team, but you also know that even when you aren't at your best, there are so many others around you that will uplift you, that will make up that slack, that will cover for you, for want of a better term. And on the days when you are at your best, on the days when you're playing well, you have to do the same for somebody else around you. You have to be able to recognize when somebody isn't having their best day, when they're struggling with one thing or another for reasons unknown to you at the time, and how you can help them be at their best. Because ultimately, that's the only way that teams win. When, you know, as the cliche goes, we're only as strong as our weakest link. We have to continue to find ways to strengthen each other, to make that team a better unit. I feel that sports teaches us so much about who we are as people, and our own responsibilities to our team. And in my later life, I've recognized how that also plays out in my own responsibilities to my community and the things that I care about.
Yeah, and that's brilliant, because I know you touched on earlier as well, when you talk about how all the experience and lessons really that you learned at Newcastle, you then took them to West Ham and you felt like you were a better performer and possibly a better leader at West Ham. Why do you think that was the case?
I just felt that I learned a lot in a short space of time at Newcastle. You know, you had no choice. I had no choice to. You know, as my introduction to Premier League football, there was that step up in class. There was a step up in expectation. When your own standard slips for whatever reason, and we all have those reasons, there is this focus on you that doesn't take those reasons into account. You have to recognize those reasons within yourself, recognize those reasons within your teammates. And as I say, it really was. A high pressure situation to learn, where either you learn or you shrivel under the pressure of that expectation. I felt that saved me better at West Ham, because I'd learned those lessons. I felt that I'd come out the better for it. I was only at Newcastle for 3 years, but I felt I came out the better for it. And I felt I was able to apply that knowledge, that new experience at West Ham better than I was. And maybe it's partly because of how I was received. Coming into Newcastle, I was seen, even though I joined Newcastle at 23, but we touched on my roundabout route to professional football. So I'd started later than most. So though I was 26 at coming into Newcastle, I was still seen as kind of a young player, and particularly back in those days, I was young maybe for a goalkeeper. That's changed now, of course. And West Ham was different. West Ham was 29, coming into my 30s. We had a very young but incredibly talented squad that included the likes of Frank Lampard, Rio Ferdinand, Jermaine Defoe, Joe Cole, Michael Carrick. All those were young players coming through, very talented, but young and inexperienced. And now here I was, this player, just coming from a team that just missed out on Premier League glory a couple of times in the last 3 years. I myself was, as I say, 29 going on 30. Bringing that experience of a Newcastle dressing room, and that kind of name recognition that I'd earned during the previous 3 years, my role now has changed. I had to adopt the mantle of being a leader within that dressing room, and I felt that I was better for it. I felt that my football was better for it, just for that understanding and that recognition from myself and from my peers.
And so when you talk about those names, you know, they are some of the most successful, you know, the best players in the world, you know, the Lampards and the Ferdinands and the Carricks. And, you know, when you're looking at those young kids at the time, because they're all 18, 19, 20, did you look at them and think, I want to help them because of the age difference and you were maybe had that possible characteristic or attribute about you? Or did you just see the quality in them and you knew they were going to go to the top and you almost just wanted to assist them in their journey?
I'll be honest, it wasn't specifically about helping any one of those players achieve some of the great things that they did. At the same time, I'm seeing myself learning, you know, as much as I maybe see myself as a leader, I still see myself as learning. And we always talk about the naivety of youth. And one of the great things with playing alongside those players, as highly acclaimed as they were, as young and as inexperienced as they were, you recognize a naivety about them and their approach. And when they make mistakes, how it doesn't seem to affect them. And that for me was another learning experience for me. That came, albeit a little bit later in my own playing career. But it's something that I felt that I took away more from them. And now I don't know what kind of an impact I had on any one of those players. Like, you know, that's a discussion you'll need to have with them. But, you know, I felt, again, just given my own experiences, I had to contribute to that team in whatever way was being asked of me. Well, at the same time, it was an opportunity for me to learn, for me to grow. And that is something, again, that I took from them at the time, that mistakes are part and parcel of all of this. And you just kind of pick right back up and carry on as though nothing happened. I'm not sure I was able to really do that effectively before sharing a space with the Lampards and the Ferdinand.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. Now, Shaka, I'm going to sort of very quickly move between the kind of your time at West Ham with all those young, incredibly talented young players. You moved to Portsmouth for a little while. We played against you and scored and we won against you. But well, let's move on from that and go back into the West Ham, your second spell at West Ham.
I will let that slide, Paul. I'll let it slide. Carry on.
No, it's more just going back into the time of West Ham, because you were in such a, you know, there really were, even though the younger players, those Lampards and Ferdinands had all moved on, it was still such a talented team you were around, you know, for the likes of my former teammate, Dean Ashton, who was, you know, scoring a lot of goals for you. And you got to the FA Cup final, and I'm guessing that must have been an incredible experience for you, because you probably watched that growing up and suddenly you're playing in it.
Yeah, it was. And to say I watched that growing up, you have no idea how accurate that statement was. You know, growing up in Trinidad and Tobago, through the 80s, we were exposed to just a couple of television programs where we got sport on weekends, one being Road to Wembley, which tracked the FA Cup. So just in terms of my own psyche, the FA Cup meant so much to me. But everything about that 05-06 season, which turned out to be my last in English football, was just so different. It was just because of who I was, you know. Now all of a sudden I've told I was surplus to requirements at Portsmouth. I'm 36 years old, not quite sure what the future holds, and I get to go back to a club like West Ham, and the remit is totally different. I remember meeting with Alan Pardew to discuss the move, and they just signed Roy Carroll from Manchester United, and he was carded to be their starting goalkeeper. And he said to me that he wanted somebody to push Roy Carroll. He wanted somebody to come in with experience that could, you know, help and coach and nurture some of the young players, but also somebody that could push Roy Carroll. So, you know, here I was, no question I was going to be the number two, but then the competitor in me, you know, at 35, and have this young upstart and Roy Carroll just joining from Manchester United, and the competitor in me is just like, yeah, this is exactly what I need, exactly what I want, you know, to be challenging him. And that's kind of how I saw that last season, as pushing Roy Carroll and using all the tricks of the trade, so to speak, in doing that. And it was a young team for the most part. There was me and Teddy Sheringham, which totally skewed the average age of the squad. But it was a very young squad. One that had just been promoted. So nobody was quite sure what to expect from them. And then to have the season that we did that culminated in the 2006 FA Cup final, we finished ninth. I honestly think we should have finished a whole lot higher. I think we were positioned probably about sixth when you get to like the fourth and fifth round of the FA Cup and you really start to think that, hold on, we could go all the way here. And that's when our league form started to slip. But we were better than, I think we finished ninth. We were way better than that position suggested. So it was a really good season, but so different from everything else that came before, for me anyway.
And it's interesting you mentioned, you know, both Roy Carroll's former teammate at Northern Ireland and Teddy Sheringham, who, you know, I think he was 40 by the time he was at West Ham and mm-hmm. actually made my debut at Tottenham Hotspur up front with Teddy. So, you know, two players I know very well and know exactly the quality that they bring. Mm-hmm. But would you say that season at West Ham was all about the sort of almost like the sum was greater than the parts?
Oh, absolutely. Without question. As I say, that was a newly promoted team. Inexperienced. Their naivety served them very well during the course of that season. But largely, as good a team as it was, as talented as it turned out to be, not many of the names were known. You know, they say Roy Carroll, coming from Manchester United, Terry Sheringham, but he's now in his 40s. Not many others kind of carried that notoriety. You know, you had Anton Ferdinand, who certainly at the time was better known as Rio's younger brother. But nobody else that, you know, name jumps off the team sheet at you. Yet here we were, as I say, I thought that that team was good enough to finish sixth at the very least. And get an FA Cup final as we did. We were by far better than the sum of the parts in that dressing room.
And what do you think it was that maybe, was it Alan Pardew that was kind of able to bring people together? I'm just trying to understand the dynamics of essentially why does a team overachieve or overperform?
You know, for that team, as you look at that team, and you know, that naivety of youth is a phrase that Alan Pardew used a lot. And I think it applied to that team more than any certainly I've been a part of. This team just didn't recognize maybe some of its own feelings, some of its perceived ceilings. It was just a bunch of young guys who were enjoying what they're doing, not at all recognizing that there was expectation or a limit to who they could be and who the team could be, and just enjoying every moment. There is a real freshness to that. There is a real freshness to being around people who quite literally do not recognize that there's a limit to who they can become. And they're just enjoying the journey, every single bump or hurdle that comes along with it.
And that's really interesting. I think it's a great insight, Shaka, because there's so many people who would probably think the opposite or could think the opposite, where they're like, you know, I do want to do this or I'd love to achieve this, but you do get those bumps, you do get those hurdles, and that stops people from carrying on and continuing. Now, listen, I don't always go into, and I don't generally want to go into specific games, because obviously you have a lot of games to talk about through your career, but I have to talk about the final. Got to talk about the fact that you were, you know, essentially very, very close to winning the FA Cup. And I thought you could have done better with Stevie G's strike.
Let me tell you something, right? So I always tell this story, right? Before we get into the specifics of that, I remember right as Steven Gerrard is lining this shot up, I hear the guy on the tannoy at the Millennium Stadium, as it was in 2006, come over and say, the fourth official has indicated there be a minimum of 4 minutes injury time or whatever it is. Right as he gets on the ball, and bam, there it is, 3-3, we go into extra time. Was it a month later, June? This would be, so yeah, not even a month, 3 weeks later, June 15th, we play in England in Nuremberg. We 1-0 down. Steven Gerrard picks the ball up at the edge of the box. And I hear the guy in the tunnel, he say, oh, the official, I was like, oh, goodness, here we go again. At that point, I should have just turned around and walked into the back of the net. From the time I heard the guy in the tannoy come over with Steve Gerrard on the ball, I'm like, here we go again. And he just puts it in the back. He bends it in the corner. 2-0. I'm like, that's how I finished. Because that FA Cup final was my last game in English football. The game against England in the World Cup was my last game at international football. So that's my sign-off. So, yeah. Thanks, Stevie G. Yeah, you're still home to me for this day.
Essentially, Stevie G ruined your career. So that's what you tell me.
He's ruined
a lot of careers.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Shaka Hislop, you're talking about coming towards the end of your career, you know, playing in the FA Cup final, that infamous goal Steven Gerrard scored from 30-odd yards out, scores against you in the World Cup. But just touching on you representing your country and playing in a World Cup finals, that must be, well, it is the pinnacle of anyone's career.
Yeah, without question, is my most proud achievement as a footballer. And just to put things in perspective for the wider audience, certainly in 2006 when you qualified for the World Cup, at the time, we were the smallest country to have ever qualified for a FIFA World Cup. We've since been eclipsed by Iceland, of course. But we're a country of 1.3 million people. We came close to qualifying for the 1974 World Cup, failed at the final hurdle against Haiti, away to Haiti. I'll also add that I think we had 5 goals disallowed. Make what you like of that. I'm not going to get either of us into any more trouble than just pointing that out. I was also a university student in 1989 when we lost at home 1-0 to the US, where a draw would have seen us qualify for the 1990 World Cup. The US, of course, qualified as a result, and they went to Italy in 1990. I never thought I'd see a Trinidad Tobago team qualify for a World Cup. I'm a fan first. I was a fan of Trinidad Tobago football a long time before I ever put on a national team shirt. So to be a part of the squad that qualified for the 2006 World Cup was exceeded even my own boyhood dreams. Or maybe didn't exceed my boyhood dreams. It matched my boyhood dreams. But a dream that I didn't think that the young man in me never thought I'd ever see. I never thought I'd see Trinidad Tobago play at the World Cup, let alone be a part. And then I wasn't actually carded to start in our first game against Sweden in Dortmund, June 10th, 2006. The starting goalkeeper was Calvin Jack, who had played fantastically well in the closing stages of our qualifying campaign. but he had picked up an injury in one of the warm-up games. But he was still down to start. And then in his warm-up, he felt his calf go again and said to Leo Benaka, our head coach, that he couldn't continue. And Benaka called on me. And in all honesty, Paul, I think that was the perfect scenario for me. Because now I didn't have to deal with those boyhood dreams. I didn't have to deal with the expectation of a 10-year-old Shaka, you know, shaping some of these dreams. I was thrown in at the deep end with little or no time to worry about what was to come next. And it worked well. So to go from maybe a few years before, in the height of my own playing career, not ever thinking I'd see a Trinidad and Tobago team qualify for a World Cup, to becoming the first goalkeeper to put on a shirt in representing Trinidad and Tobago on world football's highest stage, is without question the greatest honor of my footballing life.
Yeah, and can you just hear the emotion in your voice when you're talking about it? And, you know, I never had that privilege to do that or play in a major tournament from a country, but I can imagine how proud and how lucky and blessed you would have felt. Now, we're kind of talking a lot about all of the kind of, not just necessarily the good times, because obviously you had a lot of injuries. You talked about, you know, those dips in performances, whether it's at Newcastle or West Ham or for your country. One of the questions I like to continually ask all the people I have on the show, Shaka, is what is the price of success for you?
Oh, that's a good question. The price of success is a brutal honesty with yourself about success, about what it means, about how much you want it, about how much the road to success can beat you up. The price of success is a bruising that sometimes you may not recognize your own self in the mirror, but you have to look past it and focus on what's down the road. The price of success means sometimes looking in that same mirror, not liking what you see, but seeing the bigger picture of who you want to be and what you want to be. I admit, may sound very heavy, but I think if you like what you see down the road, it doesn't feel that way. If you have that focus, if you like what you see within that focus, and what it means to you personally, what it means to those around you, what it means to those you hold dear, whoever that may be, I think you get to appreciate what that means, how that feels, even the ugly side of it that often crops up.
Yeah, you delicately called it the ugly side. And, you know, from someone who's come from Belfast, who grew up in a, you know, in a civil war pretty much through the 70s and 80s, 90s before I left to go and joined Tottenham Hotspur at 16. You know, I definitely understand the ugly side of life and how that has affected so many people. You have a completely different experience when you're suddenly in England and you're then, you know, playing professional football. And that, of course, just brings a lot of attention on you. And for you, there was actually quite a lot of racism in your life directed towards you, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. Listen, and that for me is also I kind of part and parcel of this journey. And it's an integral part of how I define success, even on the field. And the fullness of that story, Paul, is just after I joined Newcastle, I was filling up my car with petrol late one night. I happened to be just outside St. James's Park. My wife was in the car with me. And as I'm filling the car up, a group of youths come walking down the hill and start shouting racist abuse at me. As they get closer, one of those youths recognizes who I was. As a group, they start chanting my name, wanted to come over for autographs. But I got in my car and left. Just about that time, I was contacted by a guy called Jed Grebby around, who's doing a lot of work, anti-racism work, in the Northeast with a group called Youth Against Racism in Europe. I told him about, you know, we got talking, telling him about my experience and how that overlapped with the work that he was doing. And from that, Show Racism the Red Card was born. I now proudly boast that we are in the 25th, we are celebrating our 25th anniversary this year in 2021, having formally launched in 1996. We are the UK's largest anti-racism educational charity. As of November of last year, some 825,000 children had received a full day's anti-racism education as part of our program. I continue to serve to this day, 25 years on, as honorary patron and honorary president of the organization. And I say all that not just to shamelessly blow my own trumpet, but to again maybe paint a fuller picture of what I feel success is. I feel that while there are so many aspects of my life I can point to, I can champion, that others may want to focus on, be it a 15-year playing career, be it finishing second a couple of times in the Premier League or the FA Cup. I feel that kind of given my own history, and as you mentioned, you would appreciate this, given your own upbringing. You have to give back to your community. You have to, I feel it's part of my own responsibility to not just be an example to a community, to my community, but to also provide opportunity for them. Not just provide opportunity, but make an effort to alleviate some of those hurdles that we recognize, but we've been able to overcome, but has tripped up so many others from exactly the same background that we have. And that for me is where is how I define success now. How can I make the path a little smoother for the next young boy or girl who harbors the same dreams and the same drive that I do? I may not be able to eradicate those hurdles, but I hope to at least lower them somewhat. And hope that they can go on and do the same to follow me. That for me is where I now see my own success, how I define and measure success today.
Well, that's brilliant, Chaka, because that is always my final question on the psychology of success, is because at the start I ask you, what is the definition of success? And now I always ask, what is your definition of success today? But feels like you pretty much answered it there with, in terms of the work you're doing. Just in a kind of a minute or two, can you give us an understanding of what your goals are? Because there's such a big project there for you. It's such a, you know, a worldwide issue. So what would be your success for, you know, Show Racism the Red Card? What exactly do you want to achieve with that?
Let me say, Paul, if you'd asked me this 12 months ago, I probably would, my answer probably would have been very different. But I really struggled through a lot of 2020 in dealing with the moment, in dealing with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, and recognizing how thin the dividing line it is between George Floyd and me, Ahmaud Arbery and my wife, Breonna Taylor and any one of my daughters, Tamir Rice and one of my kids. I really struggled in recognizing how easily it could have been any one of our names in the headlines. And I had a discussion with another of our vice presidents, Leroy Rossinia, former footballer himself. And he said, Shaka, you have to see this, what we're doing. Because I, and what I said to him was, I felt like I was failing. We started Sharice and the Red Card as a promise to deliver a better world to our kids. And now all of a sudden in 2020, I was feeling like I failed on the most basic of promises to my kids. And I struggled. Leroy said, Shaka, you have to see this as us running a relay. And what we are trying to do now is hand that baton off to our kids in the best possible position. Give them the tools, the experience, empower them with the confidence to go on and run their leg and hope that that's the last leg. So now you ask, what do I see as success or the end goal for this campaign or my role in it? My answer is totally different from what it would have been in April 2020. Right now, I want to empower the next generation in recognizing how every single small step counts, how every dream matters, and how every person can empower the world that we will come to recognize tomorrow.
That is the perfect way to finish our time together today, Shaka. Thank you so much, my friend. That has been so insightful, so honest, you know, brutally honest, I think is one of the phrases you mentioned earlier. And I've absolutely loved it. So Shaka Hislop, thanks very much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure, Paul.
Good man. Well, listen, if you've enjoyed that, we're really fortunate this week. We've got a special bonus episode of The Psychology of Success because this Wednesday at 4:30 UK time, we have Jarek Robbins joining us. Now, Jarek is a world-famous keynote speaker. He's a best-selling author. He's the son of the personal development guru, Tony Robbins, and Jarek will be joining us at 4:30 this Wednesday, so please do join us if you can, and thanks very much for listening. Well, I just don't really know what to say about that because every time we do an episode on this, I seem to enjoy it and get even more from it each time. And with Shaka Hislop talking about how as a kid and studying mechanical engineering at university to then going and being an intern at NASA that I didn't realize until he's, you know, researching Shaka. And then the career that he's had to get to the pinnacle of professional football, playing a World Cup, understanding what it is to be a leader within such a high quality performing team, you know, was so fascinating. And then the way Shaka summed it up at the end in terms of his success isn't just about his footballing career, as good as that was, but his is all about the work that he's doing with Show Races and the Red Card and the impact that he can have across the world by leaving this place in a much better place for the next generation. So Shaka, thank you very much for that. And I hope you joined it. If you did, please do subscribe and follow us on The Psychology of Success. And we'll join you again next time. And a final thank you to Moment Digital, who have produced today's live show. And that's Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor for all of the episodes that go up on iTunes and Spotify. Dave Webster has been our researcher. And Emily Drake does all of our social media marketing so we can get out every single episode of The Psychology of Success.